As the only experimentalist on this program today, I can comment on an aspect of Boris's career that you're worried now that I'll really talk about other things. But no, what I want to say is that Boris has also served in a very useful function as being someone who was readily accessible to experimentalists, and certainly experimentalists gravitate to him very well to get clear explanations of things in theory, and that has been extremely valuable for us. I was given already a somewhat provocative title, and I'm going to make it more so. Maybe I should get provocative about the fact that in the program I'm listed as from SLAC. It may have been difficult for some local person to get that name straight there, but anyway, I'm going to talk just about two things in effect, and one of these is conventional wisdom versus sterile neutrinos, which has been a very much maligned topic at this meeting, and I want to fight back a little bit here. The second thing is the solar neutrino connection to this, and again, I'm going to get away from conventional wisdom, which is going to make many people unhappy, I think. At any rate, if we start with the conventional wisdom today, which you all know very well, with three light-active neutrinos only, no sterile neutrinos, but no light sterile neutrinos, the large mixing angle solar neutrino solution, and total neutrino mass set by MAP recently, I want you to feel uncomfortable when I get through on all three of these topics. Now, the third one, you should already, if you heard the talks by Abizagian and Donaldson, you should already feel uncomfortable about. In particular, MAP people and the analysis have stretched things quite a bit. Lyman alpha stuff is really very much to be argued about. The one part that hasn't been attacked very much is the 2DF galaxy redshift survey, and so I just want to add a word about that, namely that Carlos Frank, who is one of the most senior people on that paper, told me that he is really very uncomfortable with their publishing that the limit that they had, felt that they'd stretched things too far. So I would say all inputs to these numbers have some problems, and you should be quite skeptical about using the number. It reminds me a bit of a double beta decay, in which generally the experimentalists find a way to pick a statistical method that makes their results look as favorable as possible. And then they go and seek the most favorable matrix elements to convert the lifetime limit to a mass limit. And then that number gets put in the abstract. There usually is some statement in the paper that, well, maybe factors two, this could be wrong or something like that. But those get ignored. People seize on that one number in the abstract. It becomes sort of an absolute thing. I'm afraid this is destined for the same kind of treatment. Let me first turn, because it was in the title at least, to the experimental situation, starting with the LSND. There has been a new analysis, which has been published, of all of the data, and that has gotten rid of a lot of things which we considered as real problems. These are not problems that people publicly have brought up, but they are ones that within the group were really worried about. The analysis is far better. It gives a somewhat larger excess of new mu bar to new e bar events than previously, but they're consistent. So all that is good. What is bad is that the new mu to new e decay in flight data was added to the new mu bar, new e bar decay at rest data in presenting final results. The new mu to new e is extremely difficult to analyze. There's only one signal instead of the two signals that you have for the other channel. Backgrounds are very much higher, and the one publication by LSND of decay in flight results had to come about after an extremely difficult analysis. And this particular analysis is optimized for new mu bar, new e bar. As the new mu and new e, for example, has no calibration information as opposed to new mu bar, new e bar, because there you have the decay of the muons, the cosmic rays, that are just in the right region. You have nothing to calibrate this signal. And so really this stuff should not have been in that paper at all. And so for that reason, please do not use, as many people do, their delta m squared sine squared 2 theta plot, because it puts these two things together, but rather something which was mentioned earlier today. The thing you should use is a joint LSND Karman analysis. That is for new mu bar, new e bar for both experiments. And it takes into account the negative results of Karman in exactly the right way, not by overlapping exclusion lines, which is not the way to do it, but rather by being able to treat these as a single experiment. And so this is something you should really believe as a result. The Bouguer line is in here just for reference. That could not be analyzed as part of this, so the actual location of this with respect to this analysis is not quite so clear. So you have these areas here which everybody mentions. You have this one up here, which has even got as high a probability as any of the others. And it would be simply marvelous if Minnie Boone showed that that was the right answer. It would just give cosmologists fits and make it really fun. So what about Minnie Boone? At the moment, they have 40,000 events, neutrino events. That's about 7% of what they hope to have. This is partly because initially their beam was only a tenth of what it was supposed to be. It's now higher than that, and by sometime in spring, additional collimators will be put in that should get up to about half of what they were planning to get in the first place. So things are going more slowly than they otherwise should have been, and the guess is that you'll get first results in about 2 years. It's too bad that the Director General of SLAC killed an even better experiment on this. I just remind you of something which was said here. It's not exactly experimental, but there is also, in addition to LSND...
CERN or SLAC?
What did I say?
SLAC.
I meant CERN, sorry.
You said SLAC.
I did not mean to say that. That there is really a very likely need for a sterile neutrino for the supernova R process. You can't prove that that's the only way to do it, but the only robust solution so far for beginning R process does involve the sterile neutrino, either in the 3+1 scheme, which is this one over here, or the 2+2 scheme, which is this paper here. So there is, particularly from LSND, reason to at least keep an open mind on the subject of sterile neutrinos. However, people tended to try to close people's minds on the subject, particularly against the 2+2 scheme. And this started pretty much with the Perez-Smirnov sum rule, that the fraction of sterile neutrinos in the solar process plus the fraction of sterile neutrinos in the atmospheric process had to add to unity. And Neutrino 2002, I heard two plenary speakers basing things on this sum rule, for example. Various people have used something rather similar in trying to fit data. The difference is that Perez and Smirnov said that there are some small angles in this process, and so they will make these three angles, three out of the six angles, zero. And this is what leads to the problem here, and because if you're going to add LS&D to this, you've got to have at least one of those three small angles non-zero. These people who fit data have to have one of them, but they still keep two angles zero, and that makes a big difference. Now, those tiny terms destroy the sum rule and also destroy these fits to the data, which are frequently quoted. 80% have to have 80% sterile and solar, and 20% in the atmospheric, and so on. Now, we reported this at Taup 2001, and never got to the stage where we felt comfortable about publishing a paper because needed to do more work, and everybody was really too busy to do it. Now, fortunately, the job has been done much more completely very recently by Tom Weiler and collaborators, and I'm going to show you something from each of these two papers, because the results are presented in a very different way. Starting off with our own, I'll show you two plots which just express the sum rule, nothing else. And we choose, and you'll see why a bit later, choose here to have to have the sum rule such that you have about 76% in the solar, the sterile. This is a function of L over E, the distance to energy in whatever the experiment is. And the sum rule condition is that these three cosines be unity, that the angles be zero. And so if that's the case, in order to satisfy the sum rule, then the rest of it has to be in the atmospheric part, and it looks like that. Now, let's make one, just one, of those small angles non-zero. Make the cosine 0.991. What happens to this nice flat sum rule here? As a function of L over E, it can be many different values. Amazingly big change for a tiny change in the cosine. If you make all three non-zero, such as to fit the solar atmospheric and LS&D data, then you get these sort of wild excursions. And so, at any rate, this is one way of demonstrating that sum rule is not to be believed at all. The Tom Weiler and company way of doing it is much more useful. And the sum rule is the upper plot here, where this is the atmospheric fraction plotted against the solar fraction. And the exclusion areas are 90% here, 99% here. And that point right there where it fits the sum rule is why those values were chosen in the previous thing, about 20-some percent of one, 76 the other. So all the small angles are set equal to zero there. Now, if, however, you do not have these zero, and you do an average over the solar neutrino energies, I'm afraid this thing is dying, let's see if this works any better. The solar neutrino energies lie between 5 and 15 MeV because we're depending on super K's results. Then, for various values of the small angles, this sum rule is certainly not being obeyed. For the energy range for contained events in the atmospheric thing. But what is especially important to point out is that these exclusion boxes are no longer valid. The limits that are obtained experimentally are done on the basis of an analysis in which these small angles are zero. And these boxes are considerably expanded if you don't make that assumption. Now, going up in energy, the upper, again, same plots, but again, here, this is the range of the semi-contained events. This is the range of through-viewing events. And you see, for choices of those small angles, that the sum rule is really very badly destroyed. So the upshot of this is that people should not believe that sum rule, and secondly, that even the fits that are out there for four neutrinos are not to be believed either. The job has not been done properly yet. So let me now switch to the second topic concerning the large mixing angle solution to the solar neutrino problem. It's in some ways important for the arguments against 2 plus 2 because of this fact that snow, supercomicon, and large mixing angle seem to imply that you only need three neutrinos. And this is certainly believed by essentially everybody. But let me introduce something here which should give you some pause as to whether this is the whole story. There is considerable evidence, as I will show you, that the solar neutrino flux is variable in time and with well-known rotation rates from the sun. This was done particularly by Peter Sturrock and company, mainly at Stanford. This guy is a professor of statistics. Such a flux variation would imply a resonant spin flavor precession. Should make Bill Marciano happy. However, Camlon requires an oscillation that's order of 10 to the minus 4, 10 to the minus 5 eV squared, whereas RSFP requires 10 to the minus 8 eV squared and small mixing. So there's apparently a conflict which would kill RSFP. I'll come back later to maybe some way this can be reconciled, but at any rate right now, please just view the data itself with an open mind and see whether it doesn't make you at least feel uncomfortable. The resonant spin flavor precession solution was invented by Lim and Marciano and separately by Akhmedov in 1988 for the now discredited solar cycle dependence. This, what I'm talking about has nothing to do with that. This requires a change from a left-handed electron neutrino to a right-handed neutrino of some other species. In other words, a transition magnetic moment. While models at that time could give the right order of magnitude, it's a long way from what you'd get in the standard model. This is a density effect like MSW. It's the same formula in effect, del m squared over e to g Fermi and effective. where ineffective in this case is the number of electrons minus the number of neutrons if they're Majorana particles, number of electrons minus neutrons over 2 if they're Dirac. And here, note that in this area of the sun, there are about 6 times as many electrons as neutrons. The adiabaticity issue does involve the magnetic field. This resonance position does not directly, although you'll see it depends on the shape of the field. MSW is the number of electrons instead. So such a resonance will be outside of an RSFP one. Now, it is interesting, just mentioning this to Boris earlier in view of the statement about neutral currents not telling Majorana from Dirac, that this is one way that indeed they could, that you can't fit the solar data with the Dirac neutrino because it is really sterile. You need the neutral currents to make the fit. So if RSFP were the answer, you'd know without doing double beta decay whether neutrinos were Majorana or Dirac. Huh? We can talk about it later, but I think you'll find that provided there is a magnetic moment that produces this result, and what? Yeah. Well, I think it does because of the fact that you cannot fit the solar data if they're Dirac. I'll show you later, Sergey. Okay, the electron neutrino survival probability, missing a letter or so there, is shown here as an example for the three different fields, and I'll tell you why later. This is interesting to look at the effects of the fields here. And in many respects, this is like the small angle solution to the solar neutrino problem, in that you choose a dip here in the region where you want to get rid of the beryllium-7. However, it is different from small mixing angle, which goes asymptotically to unity here, in that this turns over and gives you a nice flat spectrum, which then can fit the supercoming condor or snow data. So you can't tell RSFP from large mixing angle in terms of the energy dependence. So you can actually get better fits to the data with RSFP than you can with large mixing angle. Now, what about the possible evidence for this? Well, in this work of Sturrock and collaborators, the home state data was looked at first by doing 1,000 simulations of the 108 run data from that experiment, and finding in none of the 1,000 cases was there one in which there were time fluctuations in the data that were as great as in the data. So that 1,000 simulations couldn't produce that result, and so this tends to reject the constant flux at pretty good confidence level. But going beyond that, what you want to do is a time power spectrum analysis. And what was found to be dominant here was a frequency of 12.88 cycles per year, about 28 days. And this corresponds to the rotation rate in the radiative zone of the sun. There were 4 sidebands found also, which gives an indication that the tilt of the sun's axis was playing a role, and that this region where this resonance was occurring had to be at some higher latitude. And by taking the data and reordering it, you could find that there was a direct such latitude effect. The gallium experiments, on the other hand, while having some of the 12.88, had mainly a different frequency, 13.59, and that turned out to be equatorial rather than at a higher latitude as this did. And a joint analysis, say, with Olmsted shows this more strongly. Now, how do you know that it's equatorial? Well, you compare those rotation rates with the rotation rates that come from helioseismology, from the SOHO MDI experiment. And what you find is that there are regions here, this is on the solar equator, these red regions where you get a correspondence between those rotation rates. So this locates the place in the sun where this should be occurring. And I'll come back to that later and go a bit farther with that information. Now, these frequencies, 12.88 and 13.59, were also seen in X-rays in the corona by the SXT experiment in the YOCO spacecraft. 12.86 plus minus O2, and which was at high latitudes like this thing was, and this was 13.55 at the equator. And just to make that more dramatic, if you take, these are not the initial spectra, these are the probability distribution functions, which emphasize where the main effects are. The SXT results here at higher latitudes is this frequency. The Homestake one is this. On the equator, the SXT was giving this, and the Galax GNO data is giving that. So there is a remarkable match between the X-ray data and the solar neutrino data. Now, why should there be two frequencies? Well, that's because of the localization of these things and where the neutrinos originate. There's a tilt, the solar axis with respect to the equator of 7 degrees, and there are different places where the neutrinos originate. The gallium neutrinos are nearly all, if you suppress beryllium 7, PP neutrinos, which are produced at a fairly big radius, 0.18 or something like that mainly. And so this, such neutrinos can, a lot of them can pass through this region here on the equator on their way to the Earth. On the other hand, the Homestake ones are made near the sun's center at about 0.05 of a radius, and so they find it harder to make it to the Earth going through this region, and instead would be more sensitive to something that's happening at higher latitudes. And so sort of, although both frequencies are seen in both experiments, one is dominant in one and one in the other, as you might expect. Now, going back to this picture, what one is doing here is locating this 13.6 cycles per year modulation in the sun by using a resonance, if you like, between the information given by helioseismology here in terms of the radius and latitude with the frequency that you observe in the, with the solar neutrinos. And this then very definitely specifies at what density in the sun this thing should be occurring. And the density, of course, changes very rapidly. Each little tick over here is two orders of magnitude, and we're out in this region. This occurs at about 8/10 of a solar radius, and that locates the delta m squared over E from this as about 1/10 to the -14. Now, I meant to point out more specifically that was just what you needed to suppress the beryllium 7 line. Here's another plot of that, which I'll come back to in a moment. But what you needed was to be, well, this is in the reciprocal of it, but what you needed was to be in that region. Now, because this thing is changing so rapidly with radius, this could have come out very, very differently. The RSFP one, however, has to be something different. It has to be at higher latitudes, and it's not so clear what that is. It could be that the radiative zone field is somehow coming through the Tachocline into the convection zone where this occurs. Or more likely, it's a latitudinal wave that's generated in the radiative zone and comes out. And remember that these frequencies were seen clear out to the corona, so somehow it is possible that it happens. And latitudinal waves, I just want to have a little diversion here. One of the things that is very like that are Rieger frequencies, been known for 20 years in solar flares, sunspots, and so on. And they're 156 days, 78, and 52-day periods. And they're identified with Rossby waves, so-called, which were seen first on the Earth in the atmosphere, latitudinal motions. If you stick in the sidereal frequencies here, you predict these values for the periods. And you have to have L greater than or equal to 2 for rotating fluid sphere. And so what you get is then this, where the fundamental is very, very high, of course. That's the 12.88, which is to which you add 1 to get it changed in units. And then these are the Rieger frequencies, which correspond to those other periods. And these data from the neutrinos are much, much cleaner than you get from sunspots, actually. Okay. Another interesting observation is if you use the gallium data in a way which the experimentalists don't use it, although they know about this, that they can get bimodal peaks, what they do is to average a series of runs together because they say, well, one run isn't statistically significant, but that's not the proper way to handle these things. These are actually the actual runs. And instead of getting a single peak, which you should get for a constant solar neutrino flux, you get this kind of bimodality. If there were no oscillations, you'd be at about 128 here. And the lower peak's about half that, and the upper peak is somewhat shifted down from it. Now, how do you understand that? Well, going back to this picture of the electron neutrino survival probability, the PP flux drops like a rock around this region here. And so how many PP neutrinos you get is very dependent on where this survival probability intersects that rapidly falling flux. So if you shift this a little bit, you can obviously drop the rate by a factor 2. Now, there are other neutrinos involved. You killed beryllium-7, you've still got other things. And so they, instead of getting the, even when this is happening, you always have those being modulated by the outer part of this. And so you never get the 128, but you drop down the upper peak to about 100. Now, a reason to possibly believe this is this plot, in which you reorder the data so that you follow a phase of rotation corresponding to this 13.59 cycles per year rate. So these are reordered runs according to where the sun was when the thing came out. And in the downward going part of the phase here, you get strongly a peak around 50. In the upward going part of the phase here, the thing has shifted to considerably higher values. So I think that makes the bimodality more believable. However, these features that I've been showing you are not permanent ones. The convection zone area where this is occurring changes, the magnetic field changes drastically with solar cycle. And in fact, there's a paper that appeared here which said that if RSFP were right, it couldn't happen in the convection zone because you don't see time variations. Well, in fact, you do. Of course, some of these might be hard to see because if the transitions stay adiabatic, a field magnitude change won't matter. The shape of the field really, however, can affect that PP rate very much. So in many ways, the gallium experiments are the most sensitive to this. And if there's a change in azimuthal symmetry, this will also, of course, change the modulation. We'll see an example of that. Now, it turns out that nearly all the information happened between the solar maximum a little before 1990 and the solar minimum a little before 1997. This is when this 13.6 was observed in Galaxy and SAGE. And it's also the main buildup of the 12.9 in Homestake. And it's also when those frequencies were seen in the SXT X-ray case. It all happened in that interval. And show you examples of this. This is not a very sensitive way to show the effect, but this is the cumulative rate of neutrino flux, and this is for the SAGE experiment, and you can see that the buildup here in rate, there's a change of slope at the when you go from that change of cycle. A much more sensitive way to look at this is the appearance of this 13.6 rate. Again, starting off a little after solar maximum, here the thing builds up to this point when you come to solar minimum, and then there's no more evidence for the 13.6. This is cumulative, so there's nothing happening here, and that's why in GNO you don't see these effects at all. So these are drastic changes with solar cycle. Now, finally, after years of badgering, some data was obtained from Super Kamiokande, and the question is, could one predict this result? It started at about the solar minimum, and Homestake, which, like Super Kamiokande, sees mainly boron 8, and which would have made a nice comparison, stopped at about the time that started, so it doesn't give you any overlap. And it's gone, it just went a bit beyond solar maximum when the accident occurred. So there's no way from other data to predict what the Super K result should be. The Super K data itself, 184 bins of 10 days each, and it's tried to talk them out of binning it, but they did anyway. And we got this data fairly early from them. We wrote a paper about it, and then they said, nope, you can't publish it because there's something wrong with our errors. We said those errors don't matter to us at all. They said, no, you can't. And so we sort of withdrew the paper at that stage. Then Camlan came along in the meantime, but we got approval to publish, and sort of waiting to see how we could possibly reconcile these things before going ahead with it. However, someone at Saclay, when the stuff became official on the web, went ahead and did it and got exactly the same results that we did. What you see is, well, I'll show it to you. We get the timing peak because of this 10-day selection of events. You get a timing peak at 35.98, which is extremely strong. I'll just show you that. What you see here is that timing peak and the first harmonic of it. So that's totally spurious. And what it does is to produce alias events. This 9.41, as I'll show you in a minute, is an alias from the binning. This is something real, 26.57. And you notice that's at about twice the rotation frequency that I mentioned before. Now, if you take 26.57 and add it to 9.41, the alias peak, you get 35.98, which is the 10-day business. So that proves this thing is an alias. You can also test this, and I guess I don't have time to show you that or not. But you can make a subtraction and indicate that also. I'll show you that briefly, but what I want to say especially though is you do see some of this frequency in the gallium and chlorine data, but it's pretty weak. What it means is that instead of having one region in which the RSFP is not working as the sun rotates, you've got two of them going around, so you get twice the frequency. And we wouldn't have predicted that at the beginning. So even Super K shows this, and as I said, there's this separate analysis which shows exactly the same thing. And so this then is again more reason to believe that there can be solar neutrino flux variability in all of these experiments. In conclusion, I would say that the sterile neutrinos can exist in 3 plus 1 and even 2 plus 2, and one shouldn't rule them out at this point. Wait for the mini-moon result. You may have to change many of the theoretical statements that we have heard today. Get into a more complicated world than the three neutrino one. I think there is very strong evidence for solar neutrino flux variability at this point, and those observations can be understood on the RSFP model. There is a problem of how do you reconcile flux variability with Camlan. I thought I had a way to do this, but it doesn't work out quantitatively. There is the possibility that not RSFP, but spin flavor precession would be subdominant to large mixing angle, and Akhmedov and Pulido have a paper out on that. I think it's possible to do the same thing actually a little more bravely for RSFP as subdominant to LMA, but that has to be worked out. Being sensitized to this, I was intrigued to see very recently in the paper this statement, which probably has nothing to do with the case, but I'll just read two paragraphs. Tokyo's leading utilities pleading for customers to conserve electricity after the discovery of a safety cover-up last year forced it to shut 13 of the company's 17 nuclear power plants for mandatory inspections. And then it also says here, the utility was also accused of keeping two sets of inspection reports, an internal version containing accurate data and a doctored version for government regulators. Now, we hope that's not the reason that Sudan got the results it did. Camlan did, I'm sorry, I'm misspeaking again. But this also is in the spirit of this whole talk that one ought to be not too sure that we know everything about the subject at this point and only need to dot I's and cross T's, but maintain some healthy skepticism, I think. Thank you. It's just that if you do binning, then you introduce spurious peaks in your time power spectrum analysis. And but unless you have additional information, such as that initial peak I showed you from the timing, you might not know which is an alias and which is not. And as I say, I can show you more details if you subtract the thing out. You see which peaks are alias ones and unreal ones just because of the binning of the data.
But then did you add the alias time? It looked like you used that as an offset then to boost the 20-something
days. No. The real number is the 26. And it's just that if you add the alias peak to it, you get the timing peak. So you add and subtract. Well, I guess it depends on which one you chose. I think, Tom, you showed that one of them didn't make very much difference, and the other certainly did, as I remember it. Maybe you want to comment on that.
And you
put in matter of fact and agreed on it.
And high school doesn't change much. Maybe the only difference is only 5 or 3%. So it doesn't change.
Mine is that too.
Does it?
My story is pretty long. I could do it now or I could do it later. We looked at the sum rule. What that means is there's no reason to leave the global gift from somewhere and turn on if you're coming to turn on. You also have to turn back on the same time. We feel like my energy is not just helping you. There's a formidable computer problem that they have to take into account. But if we did that, then I don't think your results would be meaningful. I'm not sure why you were able to do it and they weren't able to do it. But maybe you'll tell me how to do it.
He still kept 1-0.
That corresponds to the meeting and also the meeting.
I can tell you, for what we did, let me just sum up. Two angles made big differences, including the one that touched it and by it turned on. One mixing angle made essentially no difference.
Maybe we should thank the speaker again.